is UpState Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll learn about a new technique that uses GPS to more safely diagnose lesions of the lung. But first, the CEO of the American Cancer Society with his perspectives on where we are in the fight against cancer. A million and a half Americans will be diagnosed with cancer this year, and one-third of them will succumb to it, according to the National Cancer Institute. Diet, tobacco use, and other environmental factors, as well as lifestyle choices, have a well-documented role in causing many of these cancers, significantly more so than family genetics. But just where are we in our fight against this dreaded diagnosis? Well, here with some perspective on this is Dr. John Seffern. He's the president of the American Cancer Society, and he's here to address the UpState Medical University community at this year's commencement. But he's found time in his very busy schedule to share his thoughts with us. Welcome, Dr. Seffern. Thanks for coming.
It's great to be here, Lena.
So, where are we in our fight against cancer? In other words, how far have we come and how much farther do we have to go?
Well, we've come a long way. I like to use the metaphor that for most of my life and my career, we were running into the woods, and for the first time now, we're running out of the woods. When my organization was founded, any serious diagnosis of cancer was a virtual death sentence, only to be preceded by a protracted period of pain and suffering. Now, 2 out of 3 people who get cancer survive on a long-term basis in the United States of America. Interestingly, we now have 28 million cancer survivors in the world. Would you believe 50% of them live in the United States, which has only 5% of the world's population?
Wow.
So we've truly come a long way. However, we're not out of the woods yet. We're running out of it, but and we can see light at the end of the tunnel, pardon the mixed metaphor, but we have a lot yet to do. But the bottom line is that the most exciting thing for me is the knowledge that we have evidence today that we could bring cancer under control as a major public health problem in this century. Now, remember, we know that cancer has been around for thousands of years. We can document it in dinosaurs and Egyptian mummies.
Wow.
And to think that if we do the right thing, it could be eliminated as a major public health problem is just really dramatic. And I want to make sure that the listeners understand what that means. I'm not saying that we can prevent the malignant occurrence from ever occurring, but the fact that basically 3 out of 3 would survive the disease if they get it is an exciting prospect.
It's absolutely, it's staggering, actually, especially as you noted many, many years ago, this was a death sentence. Yeah. This the C word was one to shudder.
Absolutely.
And fear very greatly. How about things like early detection? Are we doing better with that? Is it saving lives? You know, and are these techniques that we're using most effective? I mean, I know that there's been some controversy around some aspects of early detection, the PSA, for example, breast cancer screening. Tell us about that.
Well, there's no question, but what there are 3 important ways in which we can save lives from cancer. One of those, of course, and probably the most important, is to prevent it from ever happening in the first place. And we now know how to prevent over half of all cancers. So those 1.5 million that you mentioned at the outset, Linda, over half of those, we know what to do to keep this from ever happening during a normal human lifespan. The next step is what we sometimes refer to as secondary prevention, and that is getting it really early. And there's no question but what thousands and thousands of lives have been saved through early detection. Mammography is a good example. Mammography is not perfect, and we need a better test, but it has led to successive 20-year decline year over year in breast cancer mortality rates. I think of my wife, Carol. We just, my bride of 48 years, we just celebrated a wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. If she had been diagnosed with breast cancer when I got involved with the American Cancer Society when I was on faculty at Purdue University in 1972, she would have had to have had a radical Halstead mastectomy, a removal of the breast and the underlying pectoralis minor muscle. She would have had lymphedema, pain and swelling in the arm as a result of it, and a 50% chance of living 5 years.
Mm.
Thankfully, she didn't get breast cancer then, but she did some 9 years ago. And she ended up with a lumpectomy, and the sentinel lymph node was clean, and so she will never die of that cancer. She's more at risk of other cancers because she's had cancer, but clearly her life was saved by mammography and early and prompt attention.
How about the treatment modalities these days? I mean, Are we seeing, I know we are seeing some breakthroughs. They're doing things like looking for tumor markers. There's this whole idea of personalized cancer treatments where they're tailoring, based on the genetic makeup of the particular mass or type of cancer, they're tailoring the kind of approach rather than that broad brush shotgun approach. Tell us about that.
I think it's a major part of the answer. You're absolutely correct. For most of my career, we had these really cytotoxic poisons, and you tried to give the patient a sublethal dose, killing the cancer and hopefully not killing the patient. That sounds kind of crude, but that is not much of an exaggeration. Today, we are much more targeted in our approach with what is often referred to as targeted therapies. And Rene DeBow at Rockefeller many years ago in Man, Medicine, and Environment wrote, you know, more important than what disease a person has is what person has a disease. Mm-hmm. And so tailored treatment is here, and it'll only get better. Personalized medicine is the way we'll go. And eventually, one could argue that each patient will be treated somewhat differently so that you can match up what will help that patient the most and hurt the patient the least.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with American Cancer Society President Dr. John Ceferin, and we're talking about where we are in our fight against cancer. So the ACS just celebrated the 100th anniversary in the last year. What do you think the next 100 years has to hold if you look in your crystal ball? You said we're on the verge of basically beating cancer in many cases. What do you see about what's in the future for cancer?
Well, my dream is for us to bring cancer under control in this century, and I believe we can do it sooner rather than later. And that is such a profound statement from where we came from, because when our organization got started, we didn't have any answers. And then when I got involved, we had some ideas, but they had no proof. Now we have what I call proof of concept. We now are saving 400 more lives from cancer per day than we were in 1991.
That's staggering, frankly.
It gives me goose flesh. But I went to my board of directors 4 years ago in May and said to them, then it was 350, and I said, here's evidence that we're saving 350 more lives and published data. But here's evidence that it could be 1,000 a day if we do the right thing. So what I want our listeners to be mindful of is that we have to do the right things. And public policy has been an important part to solving this problem. But if we could get to 1,000 a day, that would be a public health victory, the likes of which the world has never seen. And if we can do that, then we could spread that throughout the world and talk about saving as many as 10,000 lives per day from cancer worldwide.
So now, what are the right things? I mean, you led me right down that road. You obviously have some sense of what they are.
I do. There are three things there are three things that we have to do. We have to redouble our research efforts. And there's no reason that we can't, the things that we need to do, there's no reason we can't do them all, but there are big barriers to getting them done. But we need to redouble our research efforts. Research in my lifetime has gone from a good bet to a sure bet. That doesn't mean every experiment works, but it's a building block phenomenon, and we are getting answers. The more we stoke the engines of discovery, the more answers we're getting. And I can tell you specific stories about that, but the bottom line is we don't have all the answers. We need more research. Second, we have to promote prevention into public policy everywhere. As I said, over half of all cancers can be prevented during a normal human lifespan. That means changes in public policy. And the third thing is we have to provide access to quality health care to everyone who needs it. And interestingly, we need all three, and undergirding all three is advocacy. We have to get more people engaged in the fight against cancer. We can finish the fight against cancer in this century if we do the right things. To do the right things, we have to have people speak up and say, we need more money for research. We need to make sure that people are protected from secondhand smoke. And we need to make sure that if someone has cancer, they get the care they need. That's why the new Upstate Medical University's Cancer Center is so important. I said before we started the show, sometimes people exaggerate or use hyperbole. It's not hyperbole to say that when that cancer center opens in July, more lives are going to be saved. People will not die who otherwise would die if they didn't have access to that facility.
Wow. Well, prevention, you mentioned, is also a key component of this whole approach. Yeah, I think others have argued that if we used more vaccinations or antibiotics as well as improved hygiene, we could curb the incidence of cancer. Say more about prevention. Where does the public policy part of that come in?
Well, first of all, let me say something that many of the listeners might not have thought of or be aware of. But if you look at the history of medicine and public health, you're hard-pressed to find any major disease that was ever brought under control by any means other than prevention. So whether you're talking about smallpox or whether you're talking about measles and so forth. So just, but bottom line is that prevention will be a very important part of solving the problem.
So is it better education, especially when it comes to things like tobacco use and all of that? I mean, that seems to be one of the big culprits. As a matter of fact, I just want to say that I noted in preparing for this interview that in 2008 you said that tobacco was the world's greatest weapon of mass destruction. And in 2011 you said that if companies could go completely tobacco-free, you could change the world. What did you mean? And tell us more about tobacco.
Well, tobacco is public health enemy number one. I believe, we don't have the data because we don't have good databases in some parts of the world, I believe that cancer has already become the number one cause of death in the world. It's a bit of an academic point. We know it's one of the top two or three causes of death. One in every eight deaths is caused by cancer, and tobacco, exposure to tobacco is the single largest cause of cancer. We know that. There's a moral issue here, and that's the reason I talk about weapons of mass destruction. Basically, tobacco killed 100 million people in the last century. If we don't act, it will kill 1 billion people this century. That's never happened before in the history of the world that we know of. And so 1 billion unnecessary deaths is simply unacceptable. So the tobacco industry is an irresponsible corporate citizen. It puts profits over people's lives, and we have to regulate tobacco and tobacco-related products, and we need to change social norms, and we need to have policies that protect people. We have, I think, one of the only, for sure, public-private partnerships with organizations like Johnson & Johnson, Department of HHS of the federal government, the Mayo Clinic, the American Cancer Society, and others to get smoke-free worldwide in terms of workplaces. Over 1 billion people go to work every day. Many of them don't smoke in order to try to be there for their family when they're needed, but go work and are exposed to carcinogens, and that's just unacceptable.
Absolutely. What do you think, you were talking about research as being crucial, okay? What effect, if any, has the sequester in Washington had on this? Has it really had a chilling effect on cancer research?
A devastating effect. And I just had a chance to visit with a good friend, Senator Tom Harkin, a few nights ago in Washington, and he's, of course, very concerned about it as well. We just can't back away. We worked hard with others. The American Cancer Society worked hard with other people and other organizations to double the NIH budget over a five-year period of time a decade ago, and it was done over two administrations, one Democrat and one Republican, because cancer is a bipartisan issue. Now with sequestration and so forth, that's been eroded away, and we are at terrible risk. Number one, the value proposition, if you fund research, we can guarantee you answers. We couldn't 25 years ago. We can today. Number two, investing in research has economic value. It benefits the American public. We announced a 20% reduction in cancer death rates last year. That yields American public a $10 trillion value. So it would be hard for me to exaggerate, and I think it's a failure of elected officials doing their job for which they're being paid, because we need to fund more research, and if we do, we'll get this disease under control sooner, not later. The final point is really important, and that is, I believe, we're 36 to 48 months from losing our place as the leader as a biomedical research epicenter in the world. We're going to lose our bench strength. The average age of a new R01 grant from the NCI is 41. That's not sustainable. These young people have to be able to be funded earlier, and so that their creative ideas can see the light of day.
Well, let's hope we get a little less dysfunction in Washington and we get these researchers going. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back with a lot more from Dr. Seffran.
Thank you.
Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with Dr. John Seferin, and he is the CEO of the American Cancer Society, and we're talking about how far we've come with cancer. Well, Dr. Seferin, I've heard so much about this progress we've made. Tell us a little bit more about it. You have a perspective on the progress, however. Tell us about that.
Well, we've made a lot of progress, and the evidence is clear. And as I mentioned, we have 1.2 million people who will celebrate a birthday this year who wouldn't have had if the death rates had stayed the same as they were in 1991. So it's a wonderful outcome. And indeed, the cancer death rates have gone down every year, year over year, for 20 successive years. And that yields the American public not only 1.2 million people who are still alive who wouldn't be otherwise, but it yields the American public a $10 trillion economic value. So it would be difficult to exaggerate the good news about cancer. However, there is a darker side. And I was asked a couple of years ago in my performance review, what kept me awake at night? And I said, I've never been frightened that the American public would stop supporting us because they see us in their communities doing things that they care about. However, what keeps me awake at night is knowing that most of the people who suffer today and who die today, 1,500 will die today, are dying and suffering needlessly. That wasn't true when I got involved as a volunteer 40 years ago. We didn't have answers. Now we have answers. And so it is a moral imperative that we get citizens engaged and take action, because we know if we do, we can save a lot more lives and reduce a lot of human suffering. And I think that's a moral imperative. Let me give you a concrete example, if I could. This is such great news. Guess what? Colon cancer is preventable. Now, here is like the second leading cause of death in men and women. And if we can get screening, we know that we can prevent a tremendous amount of colon cancers. And so the American Cancer Society has launched, with the Colorectal Cancer Roundtable and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a major first-time-ever nationwide initiative to screen people for colon cancer. And what we want to do is we have a goal of getting to 80 by 18. We want to get 80% of the age-appropriate population to be screened according to our guidelines by 2018. It's a stretch goal. It's going to be a lot of work, but we think we'll get there. And if we do, we know that hundreds and over time thousands of lives will be saved.
Wow, that's really an incredible goal, and very exciting to think that. There are other new screening techniques that are coming out that also will save lives. I mean, very recently we've heard about this new lung cancer low-dose CT scan that can diagnose lung cancer, otherwise the silent killer, early enough so that people's lives can be saved. Tell us about that.
Well, it's both exciting and scary. It's exciting because I happened to get started back in the 1970s and involved with the American Cancer Society because of my interest in tobacco and lung cancer, and especially as it relates to kids getting addicted to tobacco. All of my life, nothing worked. X-rays, all kinds. I'd look at all this data, and it was so sobering and disappointing because you couldn't find the disease early. Now we've proven, in the American Cancer Society a few years ago, we had all of our divisions help us, and we recruited 50,000 people to get in the National Lung Screening Trial. And they shut the trial down because it became clear that with spiral CT scanning, you could detect lung cancer for the first time ever early enough that some patients could be treated and cured. I mean, that's a huge breakthrough on the one hand. On the other hand, unlike, say, cervical screening, harm can be done. If you find a lesion, and many people, including myself, have innocent lesions in their lungs because I grew up in Ohio Valley and in Indiana, and so you have little things there that are
what they call false positives.
Exactly. And so,
or false positives.
Exactly, false positives, but you have to go in and find out if it's something or not, and so some harm can come from that. So we're at a very interesting time, and we don't have all the answers yet, but without any question, if for example, someone has the history, a certain age, and so many pack years of experience, then probably they're well served to be screened. But we want to be careful because we don't want younger people who don't have that same background to be screened unnecessarily because they might have some of these lesions like I do. And people can actually die as a result of some of the complications that go along with the workup. So it's a huge breakthrough. It's not an unmixed blessing.
Yeah, I actually, we did an interview here on this show not too long ago with our own cancer screening department and the lung cancer screening, and we were apprised of all of that. But it seems to me that a very highly trained radiologist can really look at those CTs and probably do a good analysis so to avoid the potential hazards with false positives.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's why access to quality care is so very, very important. And that's why the Upstate Medical University's new cancer center is going to save lives. And it's not an exaggeration to say that, because starting in July, people will have access to some of the latest technology and some of the greatest scientists and clinicians available anywhere in the world. And that makes a difference. And so what we have to be careful about is where someone gets less than state-of-the-art care.
Yeah, and the problem is that many people up until now have been without that care.
Absolutely.
Because of what? What's been the you were talking about that three-legged stool, excuse me, and this idea of access being one of the crucial things to fighting cancer. Tell us more about that.
Well, access to quality care has never been more important than it is today. And the reason for that is pretty simple. We've done a lot of research and we've had a lot of experience, and all of a sudden now we know things we didn't know before. But if someone doesn't have access to all of that, then they're out of luck. And so the bottom line is that we have to build out a healthcare system that really works. You know, it's interesting. We spend twice as much per person per year on healthcare as any nation in the entire world, and we get lousy results. We're 37th in the world in terms of life expectancy.
That's staggering.
About where Cuba is. And so we have an opportunity, though. We know there's that much in the way of human and financial resources in the system, and if it's applied and used differently, we can get phenomenally better outcomes where people live healthier longer. And oh, by the way, it's an economic imperative that we do that. The fact is that globally and in the United States, aging is a global and a United States phenomenon. People are living longer. And for many years, medical science was replete with halfway measures, doing better at keeping them alive than keeping them well. We have to keep people well longer. And if they are well longer and don't get a major cancer in their 50s, look at the contribution they make to their family and to society. Put differently, if they're disabled because of a non-communicable disease like cancer, it's a whole different story. They become dependent rather than a producer.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink On Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with American Cancer Society CEO, Dr. John Ceffron, and we're talking about where we are in the fight against cancer. Now, earlier in the interview, we were talking about tobacco. I know that's been your big, challenge in the world and something you've been fighting against for a very long time. But there's a new wrinkle in this whole fight, this so-called e-cigarettes that are out there. And I know that there's a lot of questions, more questions than answers, as to the potential toxicity and whether this could be a gateway, especially for younger people, to then find their way to cigarettes. What are some of your thoughts about this?
Well, Linda, you said it well. This is, this is a real challenge for us. And the tobacco control community and the public health community, but particularly the tobacco control community, is very split on this issue. On the one hand, it's conceivable that e-cigarettes could be the best harm reduction technology ever. It's conceivable, not proven. On the other hand,
at least that's their argument. That's how they advertise.
That's
if you
right.
want to quit smoking,
that's right.
use our product.
Yeah. On the other hand, it could be a gateway drug, just as you suggest, because obviously it could allow young people, and it's being very much advertised with bubblegum flavoring
exactly.
and so forth, and for them to become addicted to nicotine and then go to tobacco, which would be a catastrophe. Another issue that often isn't mentioned is the following, that one of the most, and I mentioned this the other day, most of the people take for granted that it's not all right to light up in public.
Anymore.
and how different that was when I was an undergraduate student.
Where you were avant-garde and were sophisticated if you had a cigarette.
But you could light up in any restaurant.
Of
you could
course.
Light up on an airplane. I mean, even smokers would oppose us putting smoking back on airplanes today. But this, then, could be a way in which we've denormalized tobacco use. And that's been a major thing to help us. Basically, we reduced tobacco consumption by half. We now have, for the first time in the history of the Republic, more former smokers than active smokers.
Wow.
And we now are seeing declines in lung cancer mortality, not only in men, but now finally in women. So we're talking about huge progress here, and e-cigarettes could erode back the other direction, where all of a sudden it's okay to light up an e-cigarette in some of these places. And so there's a lot of concern here, but the most important point I might make here is that we should have the principle of protection, meaning by that, that we have to have evidence that something's safe before we allow it to be done. So we believe that the FDA should move forward with its deeming rules and control e-cigarettes just like it does regular cigarettes. It also should control other tobacco products like cigars and smokeless tobacco and e-cigarettes, and force those companies to do the science and evidence as to what its harmful effects are or are not.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm hoping that FDA will take action. One of the things the American Cancer Society has, which is unique, is an incredibly powerful database. You know, you are the source people go to for information about cancer in this country, probably more than any other place. Tell us about that. How do you see that, and what role has it played in terms of defining research needs, helping to determine, you know, what's going on demographically in our country? Tell us more about that.
Well, we formed about a quarter of a century ago now, about 25 years ago, with the American College of Surgeons. The American Cancer Society established the National Cancer Database. And it was controversial at the time because we had SEER data, but this database is different because this database is the only database in America that has reliable numbers on stage of diagnosis. This is stage 1, 2, 3, or 4, what are the 5-year outcomes, and whether the person has insurance or not. And so out of that database, we were able to show during all the discussions about healthcare reform that a woman with stage 1 colon cancer that no one should die of was more apt to die than a woman with stage 2 colon cancer, which is more serious, who had insurance.
So if the stage 1 person did not have insurance and the stage 2 person did, basically the stage 2 person would survive.
That's right. And the important point here is that both were treated. So no one would be surprised if you don't have insurance and therefore don't have access to health care, you're more apt to present with a late diagnosis, with a more advanced tumor going into the emergency room or something like that. That happens. But there are also people who get diagnosed with early disease without insurance, and they still are more likely to die than someone with more advanced cancer with insurance. And that was proof positive that we had to do something to change public policy so that more people would have access to quality health care. There's no reason in the world, not one, that we can't provide state-of-the-art, world-class health care to every citizen in the United States of America. There's enough money in the system to do that. We just have to change public policy and find ways to get more people insured.
You yourself have, in the very little time we have left, I know you have a personal connection to cancer. You alluded to that earlier in the interview when you mentioned your wife, but you also had other family members who've been stricken with cancer. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I can. I think when I was 9 years old, my grandmother was diagnosed with colon cancer, and she went to the Indiana University School of Medicine hospital to be treated, came home, and we had to change our living room into a hospital room, and we got a bed on loan from the American Cancer Society. And over the ensuing weeks and months, she died a terrible death, and it impressed me greatly because she did not have good pain control, and she had no hope of survival. And when something is hopeless, it's pretty difficult on not just the patient, but the caregivers as well. Fast forward many years, my mother got leukemia. And while she did not survive that disease, it was some of the highest quality time that I've had with my family since I left to go to college, because we were with her and she had state-of-the-art treatment. And they said, here's a treatment we could do, but there's a 25% chance it'll kill you. And she just said, well, if I thought I could make it until Mary, my daughter's wedding, I'd try it, but since I can't, let's move on. And she said, who's got a joke? And my brother tried to comply with the joke, but we had some really quality time, and she died. But she died a far different death than my grandmother. And now my wife, who's now will never die of that cancer, head cancer, and an amazing experience, because we spent a weekend holding hands and talking after her diagnosis, after the biopsy came positive. And she said, well, John, what are you going to say? And I said, what do you mean? We're just by ourselves. She said, the wife of the CEO of the American Cancer Society has got breast cancer. That's an item. So, but That year, we changed our Thanksgiving plans, and she checked into the hospital at 7:30 in the morning on Wednesday, had a lumpectomy, and we walked in the back door of our house at 3:30 that afternoon, and for the first time in either of our lives, had Thanksgiving dinner at home alone.
Oh, my.
And she'll never die of that disease. So we've made great progress. We're not there yet, but we have a chance, based on evidence, to bring cancer under control early in this century, and I hope we will.
I hope we will, too. And I think with you at the helm, there's a very good chance. You at the helm of the ACS is a very good chance. I want to thank you so much for coming in and taking the time to share some of your thoughts and perspectives on this very dreaded disease, which now, as you said, we have some hope. Very hopeful news. My guest has been Dr. John Ceferin. He is the CEO of the American Cancer Society, and he spent some time telling us about his perspectives on cancer. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, goal getting, or get real. Well, folks, as you may have heard from me before, tons of research shows the single best predictor of successfully making a change in our lives is whether we believe we can do it. That belief in doing that specific task is what we psychologists call self-efficacy. And if we have an ambitious long-term goal, crucial to success is designing challenging but doable short-term goals along with a good plan to meet those goals. Now, what if we're chock full of belief, make doable short-term goals, end plans, launch away, do the plans, and don't get where we want to go? What then, you might say, Dr. Neckup know-it-all research quoting smarty pants? Well then, quit! Give up! Call ourselves a giant worthless failure. Crawl on to our next miserable excuse for a challenge until we find a simplistic task equal to our appalling limitations. No. Quitting and self-castigation are not recommended. Scientifically speaking, adapting one's expectations and goal to match our resources to reality is much preferred. Example, about 5 years ago, my mind, or my alleged mind, as my dad was fond of saying, percolated up the idea that I should beat the livestrong and chemically enhanced bicycle racer Lance Armstrong's finishing time for the New York City Marathon, 2 hours, 59 minutes, and a few seconds. I thought, very ambitious, Richie Poo. Doable? Yeah, with the right short-term goals and consistent work on the plan over 3 years or so. So I trained and I trained and trained, took my shot. Came in at about 3:23 and change. But here's where adapting one's expectations comes in. Turns out that there's a formula one can use to compare race times of runners of different ages, compensating for the biological ravages of father time. And guess what? Adjusting for age, I crushed Lance. Take that, cheater pants, Lance. What if I hadn't? Well, one can always stretch out the timeline for completion to something more realistic. Next life, for instance. But I'm still training to beat his real sub-3 time. In a couple more years, stretch out that timeline. I'm Dr. Rich, adjusting to age, O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Safer technique for diagnosing lesions of the lung. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, with your Healthy Monday Minute for June 9th. Business and family trips don't have to derail your workout routine. All it takes to stay active is a bit of research. Does your hotel have a gym, a pool, or a nearby walking trail? Bring appropriate workout gear and draft a quick exercise schedule. And remember that raiding the mini bar is not a recognized sport. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, according to the American Cancer Society, almost 230,000 new cases of lung cancer are diagnosed annually, and almost 160,000 people will die from the disease. And the newest recommendations for annual lung cancer screening with low-dose CT scans hope to save many of these lives. But these scans are not without consequences. And here to tell us more about this is Dr. Birendra Shah. He's Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Pulmonary and Critical Care Division of Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Shah.
Yeah, thank you.
So I guess this landmark study, the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial, suggested now that certain people with high risk of lung cancer should have a low-dose CT scan to determine if they have lung cancer. But it was my understanding that after these kinds of tests are done, these CT scans, sometimes there are false positives. They find things on these scans, these peripheral nodules in the lung. First of all, tell us about that. How common is it to find either that kind of CT scan or any kind of CT scan? How common is it to find these nodules in the lung?
It's pretty common to find the spots, or you can call it nodule in medical term. And when we find these nodules, we always wonder, like, is it benign or is it malignant? And to find that, the nature of the lesion, generally depending on the size of the lesion, there are different recommendations.
Yeah, what I read somewhere was that even though the majority of these nodules are not malignant, in the past, the way that you would evaluate them, in a way, could put the patient at risk. Tell us more about that.
The way to evaluate, like, once we find these nodules, the way, you know, the recommendation is if... based on the size of the lesions. If it's like less than 8 millimeter lesions, we can, because these lesions are too small to biopsy, there is a guideline. What we do repeat serial CT scans at a different time interval, and if that lesion keep growing, then we, you know, we assume that might be malignant or might be some, you know, active infections going on there. Then we recommend to biopsy those lesions. If the nodule does not grow up for 2 years on serial CT scan, then we assume that these nodules are most likely benign.
So you do some watchful waiting.
Yeah, we do watchful waiting for a couple of years if the lesions are very small.
I know that this new low-dose CT scan really has saved lives. They're talking about a 20% reduction in lung cancer mortality for people who, the high-risk people. Mm-hmm. And somewhere I read that the high-risk people are like either over 55 years of age and have over 30 pack years. So those are the people that they would want to screen.
Yeah, that's right.
But... these kinds of nodules occur in me, you and me, normal people who may not be smokers as well. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, so there's no, you know, there are different causes for nodules. It can be if people are smokers, you know, there's a high risk of that nodule being a lung cancer. But the other, like infections or the inflammations can cause development of those nodules too. So to exactly know what it is, we need to, you know, biopsy those nodules.
But now I understand you've just undertaken a safer way, a less invasive way to biopsy. Because in the past, some of the objections to this recommendation for screenings and coming up with these potentially false positives was that it could endanger the patient. And now you have a safer way to actually evaluate what are these nodules.
Yeah,
tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. So you know, when we find the nodule, as I mentioned before, to find out whether what's causing that, we need to biopsy those nodules. So whenever we find the, you know, the what kind of biopsy or what kind of method we send patient for depends on the location and size of the nodules. If a nodule is like a small, like less than 2 centimeter, or if it's located in periphery, so far we have been sending patient for CT-guided percutaneous biopsy, or sometime.
So before this, you were using the CT to guide the biopsy, and maybe that was less invasive, but now there's even something more safe?
Yeah, so CT-guided, the one disadvantage of CT-guided biopsy is high risk of pneumothorax, which is a lung collapse. Like the chance of having lung collapse after that biopsy is about 25%.
Well, that's pretty high.
Another way to biopsy those lesions are is bronchoscopy. With the traditional bronchoscopy, just to mention what bronchoscopy is, like you say, endoscopic technique, which enables us to visualize the inside of the patient's lungs airway, and it enables to take the biopsy of those lesions.
So let me just get this straight. So you're saying endoscopically, and it's called a bronchoscope or a bronchoscopy, you go into the bronchioles, which are the big tree, the tubes that connect to the lungs.
Yeah, that's right.
And you can visualize what's in there.
What's in there. But we cannot reach to the lesion if it is deeply located in the lung tissue.
So if it's on the outside of the lung, on the edge of the lung, you can't get to
it. We cannot get to that lesion with the traditional bronchoscopy.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with pulmonologist Dr. Birendra Saw. We're talking about a new and safer method to diagnose lung lesions. So right now, what is it that you're using that's different?
So now we have a new technique. It's called electromagnetic navigational bronchoscopy.
How is this bronchoscopy different?
So this bronchoscopic technique is based on like GPS-like technique.
Like a GPS?
Yeah, like, you know, we use in our car to guide us where to go. So this is based on GPS-like technique, and it guides us to reach to the lesion where we want to take biopsy from.
So it's more accurate?
It's more accurate, yeah. That's right.
And you can get to the lesion, and is that safer for the patient? How is it safer?
It's safer in the sense that, like, the risk of, if you compare with the CT scan-guided lung biopsy, the risk of pneumothorax or the lung collapse is, like, you know, 2 to 3% compared to 25%.
That's significant.
Yeah, that's significant.
So is this a brand new technique that you've just begun to use here?
Yeah, this is brand new technique. I think this came in the market. This was approved by FDA around 2005, but we got this tool this year, and we have started using it.
So who is eligible? I mean, who are the patients that you would use this for? Just people who routinely you found these nodules? Tell us more about that.
So the patients who are eligible, like who is found to have a lung spot or a pulmonary nodule, it can be incidental finding if patient gets CT scan for chest pain, if they find a nodule in the lung, or patient can present with symptoms of cough, shortness of breath, or coughing up blood, and then get a CT scan, then we can then these lesions are found. These lesions, as I mentioned before, can be from infection, can be from other inflammation, or can be from, you know, lung cancer.
But this new technique allows you to actually determine what the nature of this so-called spot is, more in a safer way.
With less complication.
What are some of the other benefits of using the navigational bronchoscopy?
So apart from biopsying the peripheral small lung lesions, which are not reachable with a traditional bronchoscope, we can also biopsy the lymph nodes, which are generally enlarged due to the lung cancer or the underlying process in the lung. And if it is from lung cancer, and to stage the cancer, like what is it, early stage or is it advanced stage, we can biopsy the lymph nodes at the same time. So far, if a patient gets biopsy of the lung nodule by CT-guided biopsy, and if there is an enlarged lung lymph node, patient again has to go through bronchoscopy to biopsy those lymph nodes.
So you have two procedures,
yeah,
you're saying.
Yeah, so we can do, you know, two procedures at the same time.
Right. So at that point, if someone really has lung cancer and their lymph nodes are involved, yeah, you can biopsy that to determine how far along they are in the cancer.
That's right.
What other things can you do? I don't want to run out of time.
So another thing we can do is to, if it is a lung cancer, we can place a fiducial marker, which is like a small piece of metal, and into the lesion or around the lesion, which can help surgeon to localize the lesion when they're doing the surgery to excise the tumor.
So you put a marker,
yeah,
to basically help guide the surgeon who's then going to go in and try to excise it. And also, there was something that you mentioned about radiation treatment as well.
So another treatment of lung cancer is radiation treatment, and the fiducial marker, we can place a catheter around the lesion, which can help radiation oncologists to deliver localized amount of radiation to treat the lung cancer.
So basically, the radiation oncologist will know exactly where to point.
Where to point, yeah.
The radiation, because you've put a marker in the in place. That's really very interesting. So this is being done now as part of the pulmonary care.
Yeah.
At Upstate Medical University. Right. Where is it taking place?
It takes place in endoscopy suite where we perform all the bronchoscope. It can be done in operating room too.
So is this a one-day procedure? Is it people have to stay over, or is it an outpatient?
It's one-day procedure. After the procedure is over, patient can go home same day.
Very, very good. Well, that's very exciting technology, and it sounds like
we're using these
navigational guided. This is electromagnetic.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Well, thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Birendra Sah. He's assistant professor of medicine in the pulmonary and critical care division at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks a lot for coming
in.
Thank
you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Today I'd like to read two poems about the period that comes after diagnosis and treatment. Sometimes it can be a wonderful halcyon period. Slowly, the mind and body begin to heal, and we can believe once again that life might be possible. The first poem is by Andrea Potos. Her latest book, We Lit the Lamps Ourselves, was just published by Salmon Poetry in Ireland. Here is her poem, Recovery. So this is it, the hour-by-hour decisions of the body to go forward or to stay. Some days to step back and wait, as if the glare of all that light may be too strong to take in all at once. As if the enormity of life awake must be accepted unanimously, cell by astonishing cell. The second poem is by Liz Whiteacre, who teaches at Ball State University. Her poem juxtaposes the patient's careful watching of the bird feeder outside her window with the instructions she's received from her physician. Here is Morning, propped on the sofa. The chickadee outside the window perches with house sparrow, mourning dove, and a cardinal pair. Find the least painful perch. Together, they pick through suet and millet, digest cracked sunflower seeds, budge for a blue jay on the feeder, swallow the small brown pills. Each seems conscious of another's space. Seeds ping on the air conditioner, while balanced birds graze methodically, adjust ice packs. Just past dawn, the yard is calm. No meddlesome squirrels to hog the plastic-coated cage. A starling descends, arranges his feathers. Prop more pillows behind the spine. The starling angles his head to eat from the feeder's south side. The chickadee, house sparrow, mourning dove, cardinals, and blue jay flee. Elevate the legs. They sit at a sycamore's naked branches and observe with me, wait to nibble, peck, choke down leftovers. Wait.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore medicine, art, and relationships, and how they intersect. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog. That's upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.